Bat Segundo here, and I'm extremely upset that I have to introduce one of the great scoundrels now coasting by on his past television achievements. You see, Gabe Kaplan thought he could pull a fast one on me. He emailed me out of the blue and told me that if I sent him $500, that he would be able to resuscitate my now decayed radio career. Well, I wrote Gabe back and told him that due to the meager pay I get from introducing these podcasts, I'd be happy to send him $500 on the installment plan, writing a monthly check for $2.99. After all, that's only one 40-ounce bottle I'd have to give up each month, and I could always make up for this with extra tequila. Well, Gabe then told me that he had fooled me, and that he was writing a book about it. Well, I adamantly refused to be part of the proceedings, not unless he paid me $500. And now, here's our young roving correspondent trying to disgrace me further by having the temerity to interview Gabe Kaplan on my show. Well, thank goodness the blackguard didn't have much of his voice. Take it from me, kids. Sometimes a little bit of voodoo magic works wonders.
Okay, so I'm here with Gabe Kaplan, author of Cotter's Back. I apologize for my voice, but Gabe, how are you doing?
Doing great. Having fun. My second stop on the tour to plug the book.
Now, have you written anything else in terms of book-wise before?
No, never. And this is a kind of unusual book, so it's sort of my first shot at it. And seeing, see how people react to the book, because I have other ideas for humor books, but I took a first shot with this type of book.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about the sort of context of this book, which is essentially sending emails out to various people and fooling most of them. Some people took the emails in good humor, some actually took them seriously. And I wanted to actually kind of ask you about this. I mean, you've described the origin in other places that it came from, the celebrity boxing scenario. But I'm wondering why people reacted so seriously. Do you think it was the email format, or do you think it was your sort of celebrity kind of stature, such as it is?
Well, I think people will believe my celebrity stature as it is a good way to describe it, because I'm a celebrity who people haven't seen for a long time, and people are willing to believe anything about what happens to a celebrity they haven't heard from, because so many do go off the deep end. So it was sort of a microcosm of human reaction when I sent out these strange emails, where some people would try to help me, some people try to take advantage of me, saw it as an opportunity to make money, other people just wanted to be involved with someone they remember from television. So the reactions varied, but I think most people took what I said, no matter how ridiculous or surrealistic it was, at face value.
Well, there's a particular tone to all the emails that is very sort of friendly and very businesslike, and I'm wondering what steps you took to kind of perfect this sort of approach to various people.
Well, I wanted the people to believe what I'm saying. When I saw that there was a big auction going on, a celebrity auction, so I wrote to one of the big auction houses, and I said I wanted to have an auction for Welcome Back Cotter memorabilia. And, when you're talking to someone who does auctions for a living and is one of the major auction houses, you can't do a whole list of ridiculous items, because they'll know that you're putting them on. So I wanted to walk that fine line between reality and fantasy and humor. So some of the items I said could be possible if I was in a position where I wanted to do a Welcome Back Cotter auction. Some of them were feasible, and then some were completely absurd. So I treaded the line, the thin ice between reality and fantasy with some of the items, and the man who was I was contacting accepted what I was saying and just thought I was somebody who thought that the old underwear that I wore on Welcome Back Cotter was saleable and was going to humor me and say, well, we hope we can sell it. And I described other ridiculous items that no one would actually feel were saleable, but he was anxious to get the other items, the ones that he considered the real items, in the sale. So he didn't want to tell me, well, you're out of line with this, you can't really sell this. He just said, well, he gave low estimates on the ridiculous items and fairly strong estimates on the items like the the jacket I wore from the pilot of Welcome Back, Carter, which could be a real item that someone could sell. And I still have that jacket. And I could, you know, if I wanted to, do an auction of Carter material. So it was a, you know, it was a combination of reality and surreality about some of the listed items.
I'm just wondering what kind of real sort of success rate you had in duping people, because it seems fairly obvious, like a beginning Scientology book by John Travolta. All you have to do is study John Travolta's career and realize that he had actually discovered Scientology midway through the run of Carter, you know?
Right, and Scientology would not put out a book called Beginning Scientology.
Exactly.
You know, so that item could not exist. But he didn't study it enough to find out, or it didn't click with him right away that was a phony item. So basically, he was so enthralled with doing the auction and thought it would be successful that he didn't, or maybe he did. Maybe he knew there was no such, or maybe I don't know what he thought. But at no point did he suspect that I was putting him on, even when I said that why don't we combine the auction with a garage sale at my house, where I can sell some of the items that are in my garage, plus the Welcome Back Carter stuff, and it can all be held on my lawn. He said it was an interesting idea. He thought that was funny, and I said I could make lemonade, and he said, well, you got to put vodka in it for the people that go to these auctions. So he thought he was laughing along with me and didn't realize, I don't feel at any point that it all was a put on. But when I did contact him,
yeah.
And I said, because everybody that ultimately wound up in the book or using their real name and email addresses gave permission. There was a couple of people that we couldn't contact that we didn't know where to contact. They never gave their addresses. The only address we had was email address. So if we used any of those, we totally changed their name and email address. But there's only like 3-4 of those. And all the other people gave us permission.
Even the misspellings in the emails I noticed, were those actual reproduced from the actual emails?
Yes, all the misspellings in the emails.
Including yours, too.
Right, including my bad grammar at some points, and misspellings were all, it's all, the only thing we did change with is a couple of people, celebrities that I referred to, who have since been deceased, and we changed a couple of names to put celebrities who were in the same vein. Because I didn't want to do that, but that's the only thing. Or in a couple of instances, one person asked that one sentence in one of his emails that really made him look a little foolish be deleted, so we took that out. But other than that, I would say it's 99.8% all of the original emails, my original emails and their original responses.
Now, did this whole thing kind of arise out of boredom, or, I mean, just having a lot of time on your hands?
Yeah, I did have a lot of time on my hands. Yeah. And when I got the celebrity boxing email, and they were seriously asking me at 58 years old to get in a ring and to fight someone who was my age, no matter how out of shape or no matter how ridiculous or no matter the fact that somebody could really seriously get injured if one guy was in shape and one guy wasn't, they didn't care about any. This was ratings. This was Dick Clark production, and Dick Clark is a successful TV producer who goes after ratings. And if people will tune in to watch 60-year-old ex-celebrities fight each other, then he'll put it on television.
Yeah.
And when they answered seriously, I began to suspect that there was a lot more to this, and that if I sent out emails on things, like if I read there was an auction and I sent it out to an auction, if I created a new act called Gabe Kaplan and the Pips to replace Gladys Knight and the Pips, if I wrote to the Postmaster General of the United States and wanted my image on a stamp, or if I wrote to Sioux City, Iowa. And Iowa was, when Welcome Back, Carter was on the air, Iowa in general gave it its lowest rating. So when I wrote to Sioux City, Iowa, and I said, I want you to have a parade to celebrate my 60th birthday, and they replied that they were interested in having this parade, I thought it was great, and we discussed the details of the parade. And then when I called them and said, I'm sorry, but this was a joke, but you don't have to be in the book if you don't want to be, they said, not only do we want to be in the book, but we want to have the parade. Yes. And we just had the parade last Friday in Sioux City, Iowa. They had a Gabe Kaplan parade, and everybody got into the joke. And I was on a float, and there were high school bands and everything. It was amazing. It was sort of a fantasy, a joke that everybody got into.
The thing that actually sort of astonished me about when reading this book is the fact that you do this all through email. You don't actually phone these people, and yet they actually believe that you are, in fact, Gabe Kaplan. Why do you think that is?
Most of them believed it. What I said sort of made sense. Some of them questioned it. The celebrity boxing guy I had to talk to, and he would not. But I said, I want our correspondence to be recorded, so I want to continue it through email so there's a record of it. And because I said, look, I've been screwed so many times at television shows promising one thing, so I want to make sure now that you know it's me that we keep a record of everything we say. And he said, fine. And there was one or two other people that had to talk to me, and I wanted to continue it. But most of the people accepted that it was me from the email address, which is gabe@gabekaplan.com. And from what I said, they had a feeling that there was a reality to what I was asking, and they accepted it. So I don't know why. You would think that people would say, how can I believe that you're really Gabe Kaplan? But that didn't happen a lot.
So if I actually had a domain, danny@dannybonaducci.com, people would believe it, perhaps.
It depends. It depends how you compose the email, what you said, and if it was believable, and the situations that I put myself in or the things I was asking for from these people, they mostly believed it was me and wrote back and replied. And sometimes they would say, you know, can we talk? I'd like to have a phone conversation. And I said, well, let's work out the details first because I'm so bad. I can take advantage of on the phone. So if we agree on everything first, I'll be happy to talk to you. So that's what happened in a lot of these instances.
Now, I'm wondering, in terms of getting back to people, there are specific date timestamps. Did you keep a record in terms of keeping someone in suspense, like say, oh, I'm not going to get back to that guy until like maybe 3 days from now, let him sweat a little bit until I get a response? Did you do anything like that, or was it largely kind of responding whenever you felt like it?
Yeah, it was mostly responding whenever I felt like it. Some days I would get into it, and I would, I wrote a rap song, which is sort of an X-rated rap song, and I wrote to a mainstream producer of rap records and said I wanted to be a rap artist and I want to produce an album, Kata Raps or Kaplan Raps, and I wrote this X-rated rap song, and I got into it. Like, for 2 days, I really tried to write a rap song that you would hear, and when I said it to him, he said, your skills, you know, spelling skills the way they do in rap, are very nice, and, you know, let me know exactly how we can continue this. But he complimented me on the lyrics and thought they were good. So then I would take a couple of days off and do something and not answer any. But it was amazing. You know, every day was an adventure checking my inbox and seeing who had replied. And generally with each topic, like when I wanted to do Gabe Kaplan and the Pips, I would send emails to three venues and see if somebody answered. Like performing arts centers. I picked like three of them. And one guy was interested in booking Gabe Kaplan and the Pips.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic. Now, how often, I mean, how much time did you labor over a particular email to actually get the tone right?
Some came real fast. Some really had to be delicately composed to go over that fine line where, you know, because they're not silly. You know, there's been books like this before that were written by fictitious people, starting with the Lazo letters, and which weren't that believable, and Letters from a Nut, which was written by a comedian who's a very good friend of Jerry Seinfeld.
And referenced in the book, too.
Yeah, and a lot of people feel Jerry Seinfeld wrote those, but he didn't. It was this comedian. And really silly stuff, you know, and funny. Really funny stuff, like I'm coming to your hotel and I like to enjoy dressing up as a giant kidney for 2 hours a day and sitting in the lobby. I won't urinate or anything, but I'll sit in the lobby dressed as is all right with you. And then people would respond and saying, oh, I'm sorry, but you can't dress as a kidney and sit in our lobby. So those were the type letter books that had been successful, written by fictitious people. So when I did it as myself, it produced a little different reaction. And my goal was not to be really silly, but to have the humor come from the situation that was created, to see how people deal with each other, and particularly how people would deal with a celebrity and who was taking advantage of who. There was one where this guy is supposed to improve your self-confidence. And I used a lot of Winston Churchill quotes in it, and saying that my funniest hours were past me and I needed self-confidence. And what is my goal? My goal is to get laughter at all costs. Yeah. And
And that thing was the longest one in the book in terms of the correspondence.
And he wrote back, no, you're thinking of the career planning.
The career planning. That one too. I'm getting those two mixed up. But they have the same kind of mentality. It seems that this corrective impulse.
But this guy, the career planning guy sort of got in, and I got the feeling he was really trying to help me. This guy said, in copying my words, because he tried to get the wavelength I was on, and he put himself on a Winston Churchill wavelength, and he said, don't worry, Gabe, you will have your funniest hours. So he was using what he thought was my vocabulary, which was really Winston Churchill's vocabulary. Yeah. So things like that I find amazing, that he tried to dupe me by using what he thought was the way I was thinking. Now, the career planning guy, you know, who I said, I haven't had a career in 20 years, my show business career is over, I have to do something else, can you find a job for me? I've been offered a job as the muffin man at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where I come out in apron and I'm the celebrity muffin man, and I go in the kitchen and bake muffins. And he said, that's too demeaning, I'll get you a better job. But I had the feeling that this guy was trying to make money, but was also really into my situation and cared about finding something or wouldn't be demeaning for me, and was interested in it. And I said, they offered me a job as a tour guide on Ellis Island, where I have to dress as an immigrant circa 1880, 1890, and show people what it was like, the Ellis Island experience. And he said, that's not a good job for you either. You shouldn't have to dress up to, I'll get you a job. So I felt that he cared more, even though he was trying to make money. So there was a level in each one, each person, you know, you can have a feeling of who was responding and what they were trying to get out of me or do for me.
Now, there's a certain kind of element to some of these emails in terms of offering mouse pads, T-shirts, and free poker lessons. How did that come about? I mean, it's like this little sort of, did you introduce that when they weren't going to be likely to respond to your emails, or?
No, I introduced that when a fan, I started most of the correspondences, but there was a few that just found my email address and emailed me, and they started it first, and one was someone who wanted an autographed picture and said, how much does it cost? And I said, I'm running a special this week, an autographed picture, a Gabe Kaplan mouse pad and other little keychain or whatever, and you know that, and I'm not really making a lot of money on this, but I want to please my fans. And some people would reply that they wanted the picture, they didn't want the mouse pad. And my favorite one of the people who wrote to me first was an old friend of mine who I hadn't seen for 45 years. He found my email address and he said, Gabe, you know, I just found out, because my name is Harold, and Gabe was sort of a name I adopted and used, and I just didn't, I grew up with the name Harold and I wasn't thrilled with it, so I called, my last name is Kaplan, so he remembered me as Harold, and he said, dear Harold, you know, I just found out you were Gabe Kaplan. I watched Welcome Back, Kotter, and knew that there was something about the characters, and we haven't seen each other since junior high school, and I'm so thrilled that you're Gabe Kaplan, and, you know, would you consider starting a correspondence with me? And I wrote back and said, you know, it's great that you contacted me after 45 years. We haven't seen each other. Love to talk to you. By the way, would you mind sending me $500? Because I hope you're in a more secure business than show business. And he wrote back that, what's going on with you? And I said, well, you know, I've been in rehab, and I joined the militia movement, and I was in a cabin in Idaho for a while, and it's misplaced patriotism. And he said, wow, you're really pushing the envelope. I'll be happy to send you the money if you need it. And then I wrote him back, well, thank you, but I'll explain it sometime in the future. But this guy who I haven't seen for 45 years was willing to send me $500.
Wow, yeah.
So, and I think that was something to saying about, well, you know, how would people react I think most people that I knew 40 years ago, if I asked him for money, would say no. But this guy said, yes, I'll send you $500.
There's also the instance of the item that made it into Radar Magazine.
Right.
Of the, you know, this sort of Stalinist historian don that you donned, you know?
Yeah. A lot of the items are based on history or historic events. And I wrote to a Yale historian, especially on the Stalinist era in Russia, and I said, is it true, there's rumors that Joseph Stalin was into genital origami, where he would have these shows where he would twist his genitals into different shapes and figures, and he would make the whole Kremlin watch him. You know, this is bizarre. And the historian didn't know what to make of it, didn't want to know if I was serious, if Joseph Stalin really this crazy? Could something like this possibly be true? So he sent it around to other historians and writers.
Including Christopher Hitchens.
Including Christopher Hitchens, wondering if it possibly could be true. And a writer for Radar Magazine called me up and said, you know, this is going around and people are wondering if you really believe this, or is it any, do you have any possible proof that Joseph Stalin did it? And I had to tell him that it was a joke. And he put an article about it in Radar Magazine, sort of suggesting that it was, but he wasn't sure at the time if I really believed it or not. So even these historians were not 100% sure of anything throughout history, because you can hear something about some historic figure that you never heard before, and you know, Hitler was gay. Is it true? Joseph Stalin was into genital origami. Is it true? I had a few writers on a few of them. A few of the emails made it into the media. Not the emails, but the question about whether or not they were true. There was one that I wrote a book company that deals in a lot of sexually charged books from way back, from The Sensuous Woman. And the publisher of that book, I wrote him that I had known Will Chamberlain, and I had read Will Chamberlain's book that he slept with 20,000 women, and I have spent the last 10 years trying to break his record at 2 women a day. And when I break the record, I want to publish a book about my experiences with all 20,000 women, like what it was like. And right now, there's nothing sexual, nothing fun about it. I'm just grinding it out in between my nap schedule. I want to write the book. And he really was serious, and he said, this is a great idea. We'd love to write the book. I have the person to write it with you, a great ghostwriter you can work with. And this, and the New York Times found out about this. So a writer from the New York Times called me and said, what is this book you're going to write? And is this real? And she believed it. She believed that I was this guy who was trying to sleep with 20,000 women and wanted to publish an article pre the publication date of the book. And I had to tell her, look, it's a joke.
This wasn't Motoko Rich by chance.
I don't think so. I don't remember her name, but it was. Is there a gossip columnist, an occasional gossip columnist in the New York Times?
I do believe so.
And that's the lady it was. That's the lady it was that writes that column. She and I said, look, it's not true. It's a joke. I have to explain. She said, why? I said, I can't explain exactly, but I can just tell you it's not true. And if you publish it, I'm telling you that it's not true, and I can't go into more detail. And she respected that and didn't publish it.
The question I have is, I mean, obviously this has kind of been the first time in your life that you've played hoaxes and pranks upon other people. I'm wondering, do you feel that the internet as a medium is a kind of better way to, you know, fool people, or are people just too trusting today?
Well, I think people are too trusting. I think it's a pain. I had a real dilemma about whether or not I was going to publish this one, because I basically finished the book like 3 years ago. I spent a year off and on doing it, and writing the emails and getting the responses, and I had a lot of fun doing it, and I really didn't think I infringed too much on people. But then when it was time to publish it, and a couple of publishers were interested in publishing it, I had second thoughts, and I said, aren't I just as bad as anybody I'm representing if I'm going to take these unwitting people and publish what they say? You know, when people do this, and people are unaware, I don't think it's fair. I think there's something degrading about it, and part of me is a prankster, and part of me loves fooling people on the phone and doing voices of people that know me know I do that a lot. And but part of me is against the infringement of taking somebody's rights away. So I said, I can't publish this. I can't do this. I can't put this out. And there was some really funny ones that didn't make it in the long run. But what happened was, about 6 months ago, somebody was constantly trying to get me to publish it. And they said, well, why don't you just call the people? And if they don't want to be in the book, don't put them in the book. So that way you're only putting people in the book that want to be. And I said, that's a great idea. I don't know why I didn't think of that. So I started contacting everybody and saying, do you want to be in the book? And I would say 90% of the people ultimately said yes. Some of them had to think about it for 2-3 days, wanted to see the emails again, wanted to see exactly what they had said and what I had written, and replied. But there was a few people who definitely did not want to be in it, and some known people. And I can tell you one, because he's deceased, Jerry Falwell.
Oh, really?
I had a tremendous exchange about religion and televised religious
I didn't know you had an email address.
Yeah, well, I originally emailed Liberty University, and it's okay. I originally emailed Liberty University to try and get into contact with him, and then he wrote me back personally.
Really?
And he said, "Gabe, how good of you to contact me." And we, exchanged emails. And if you like Jerry Falwell, you would find nothing wrong in what he says. And if you thought Jerry Falwell was a buffoon, his buffoonery would come out in the emails. So your opinion of Jerry Falwell wouldn't change when you read these emails. But he was very offended that I duped him. He didn't answer my correspondence after a while. Definitely let me know that he didn't want to be in the book. And I respected his wishes and didn't put him in the book.
Wow, interesting. I'm wondering, though, if any of this kind of tomfoolery has something to do with your portrayal as Cotter, because here you are, a former stand-up comic who plays this character who, you know, is of authority. And maybe that, do you think that the emails kind of, I guess, kind of ladder version of this, of being also funny, but just clearly authoritative with your emails, getting people to respond to you like this?
I do think my role as Cotter helped getting people to respond, because Cotter was kind of parental. He was the kind of teacher that everybody would want to have. Cotter is one of those shows that found its way into the pop culture. It wasn't that big a show when it originally aired. It was a top 20 show, but it wasn't, you know, in the top 5 or top 10 most of the time. So it was successful when it was on, but it wasn't massively successful. But it's more successful now in people's memories. So it's like almost Star Trek, that didn't have a big audience when it first aired, but it sort of grew in pop culture. And that's what happened to Welcome Back, Cotter. So I think being Mr. Cotter and being on that show made people take me seriously. And the fact that they've never heard anything crazy about me made him think, well, this could be real. This guy could be serious, and let me start this correspondence since he's contacted me first. And I'm sure, you know, the Postmaster General of the United States wouldn't reply to somebody else who wanted to be on a stamp. It wouldn't reply to everybody who said that, but he replied to me and gave me his reasons why he couldn't put me on a stamp. The Athens Olympic Committee replied to me and explained why I couldn't be the main guy to light the torch like Muhammad Ali was in Atlanta. You know, I told him I wanted to be the last guy, that I deserved to be the guy that lit the Olympic torch in the Athens Olympics. And the head of the torch lighting ceremony wrote me back and explained to me why, in his opinion, I wasn't right.
Well, the other thing that's striking about the response is that no one actually wrote back and said, Jesus, you're a narcissist for thinking to be on the stamp like this, or for thinking that you could actually date two women at the same time.
Right.
I mean, they kind of had this, there's this bizarre sort of respect for you, whether it was the sort of Cotter archetype reflecting into these emails, or I would argue possibly sort of the authoritative tone that's, you know, maybe people don't use anymore, you know, in these emails.
Yeah, I think it was the tone that I used. I think it was who I am. That I think if somebody, you're talking about Star Dates, which was a television show where they would have a celebrity go on two dates on successive nights with two different men or women, and then give their opinion about how the dates went, and then the person that they dated, both people that they dated, would say how they liked the celebrity. And it was on for a couple of years, and I got a request to be on Star Dates, and I said, I think it's a great idea, but what I want to do is I want to have both dates together, and I want to do a threesome that night, and that's how my lifestyle is. I always date two women at once. I can never go out with one woman, so, will Star Dates do this? And they thought about it.
Yeah.
They said it went up to the top brass at E! Television, And they finally decided, no, that they couldn't do this. But they wrote me back, sorry. And the guy who wrote me back said, I thought it was a good idea, but they've decided not to do it. So they took it totally seriously that I would be that narcissistic and that sexually involved with threesomes that I couldn't actually go out on a single date, that this was my lifestyle of having to date two women at once.
I know you have a reading to do just very soon, so I'll ask you one last question. I wanted to actually ask you about this kind of phenomenon on television that you actually sort of spawned with Cotter. Going back to what I was suggesting earlier, the stand-up comic as the sort of authority figure. In every sort of, I guess, you know, high school television, and your former opponent, your prospective opponent, rather, for the Celebrity Boxing, Howard Hessman, same thing, comes from an improv background. Why do you think that this is kind of, I guess, the kind of teachers that they draw upon for television in terms of actors, people who come from stand-up comedy who are then in this kind of authoritative mold? Why do you think they picked you, and why do you think this continues to this day?
Well, I think it had something to do with they picked me, and I was, I think, the first person who they did a sitcom about basically their stand-up comedy. I would talk about being in a school with Sweathawk type of guys and growing up in that kind of New York City school system where they always put you in a class with people who were as bright as you were, and this was my act. So we just translated it into a sitcom where the only fictitious character was Cotter. Yeah. Everybody else was based on somebody that I had went to school with. And when it became successful and other comedians started, comedians had sitcoms before, but Don Adams didn't do a routine about Maxwell Smart, and Joey Bishop didn't do a routine about being, a nightclub owner, or Danny Thomas. They just fashioned a sitcom around them, not around their material. Then they started to do that. You know, they did Roseanne Barr and Jerry Seinfeld and George Lopez and all the comedians now. Ray Romano. They do sitcoms based on their stand-up comedy. So that's what I started. And I think I was sort of so into the character, and it was so much of the teacher that I wanted to have, not only that everybody wanted to have, but I wanted to have a teacher like Cotter. I wanted to have somebody who really cared about me. So I felt that character, and I think that came across, and maybe that's why. And then everybody else who followed with their own sitcom based on their material was so familiar with that character. Roseanne Barr was so familiar with the housewife because that's what she had talked about in her stand-up comedy before she got the show. And Ray Romano's talked about his family and raising kids and the trouble and his home and his in-laws and his parents. And that became, everybody was Raymond. So the familiarity with the character, I think, is what people identified with and believed.
But do you think something has been lost in television since the 70s, and because now it's become more star vehicle as opposed to more character, as it was perhaps with Cotter?
I don't know if the sitcoms are as good. I don't watch a lot of them, so I don't know how good they are. But I know there's so many choices on television today that there's got to be something you can watch. People complain about television, but you know, there's so many shows. If you like history, there's so many shows that you can watch. If you like sports, there's so many shows. There's so much sports television. There's Discovery Channel. There's all things that are interesting. And then there's the regular network television fare, if you like that. If you like reality shows, if you like cop dramas, if you like sitcoms, everything you could possibly want. There's so many channels. Everybody has cable, or everybody has a dish. So there's so many choices. I don't know what people are complaining about. If you don't want to watch it, don't watch it.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Well, Gabe, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.